Welcome to the Generations Radio Broadcast. Kevin Swanson, your host with you. Steve Vaughn also in the studio. And friends, today we're going to talk about worldviews and how they affect economies. It's interesting, we live in a world or a nation in which people live in houses twice the size they were, on average, in 1900. With half the kids.
Right.
People love drywall. But here's the kicker. Twice the square footage, half the kids, and seven times the debt.
Wow. How do we do that?
What does that tell you? What that tells you is we don't like kids, we like drywall, and we really, really, really like debt.
Yeah.
Yeah. Only because the numbers reflect values. The numbers reflect values. Now, again, we're not pointing a finger to any individual person. We're just saying that's the nation. That's us. As a nation. As a nation, America has become a nation in which we love our drywall. We don't like kids, but man, we are in love with debt. And now these are important stories that I'm going to share on this edition of the program. Why? Because we live right now in the good times and probably the last of the good times. We've come out, kind of come out. We have not really recovered. Nobody's saying we've recovered. I don't think anybody's saying we've recovered.
Obama does.
Obama does. Okay. But I don't hear that from Fox News economists.
Right.
You know, that kind of thing. I don't think we've recovered since the 2008 recession. But we are doing better than we were in 2008 on things like employment, a few other things. And so it appears that we have something of a recovery in operation. But here's the kicker. A third of Americans are still delinquent on debt. And it hasn't changed over the last 6, 7, 8, 9 years.
Wow.
According to this story from USA Today, more than a third of the country is in trouble when it comes to paying debts on time. 35% of Americans have debt in collection, according to a study out Tuesday from the Urban Institute, which analyzed the credit files of 7 million Americans. That's a lot. 35%, that's a lot.
That's
How would
huge.
You like to be a credit card company? How would you like to be a bank?
Well,
you realize a third of the people are not going to be paying their debts.
Well, banks,
a third, that's
banks
35%.
Use that to their advantage, though. That's
fractional
that's
reserve. Outrageous. Yeah. Oh, I know. I know It's all a fractional reserve banking system. So
We're
just, you know, kicking the can down the road again and again and again and again and again.
Yeah.
I don't know how many times you can kick a can down the road before the can is so big that you just can't kick it anymore.
Yeah, fall off the edge of the world.
Southern states especially stand out with the highest concentration of people delinquent in 13 states. Alabama, Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, Kentucky, Louisiana, Mississippi, North Carolina, South Carolina, Texas, Nevada, New Mexico, and West Virginia, and Washington, D.C., more than 40% of the population there have a credit files debt in collections. Nevada's the highest at 46.9%. Excuse me. South Carolina's the highest, then Nevada.
Okay.
So South Carolina, if you live in South Carolina, that's the worst state for being underwater. Okay. South Carolina's the worst. Nevada, Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, in that order, are the worst. And when it says debt in collections, we're talking about people who have a debt that is over 180 days past due. So this isn't just a month. This isn't just 2 months. This is 6 months. They've been at this for 6 months. They have not been licking those stamps for 6 months.
Wow.
Debt in collections can remain on a person's credit file for up to 7 years. 77 million Americans with debt in collections owe an average of $5,200. That doesn't sound like a lot, but you got to understand some of them are owing $250,000.
Right.
And some of them are owing $3,000, but the people owing $3,000 are worth like $5.
Yeah.
Among Americans with credit history, the average total debt load is nearly $54,000, but that number is significantly skewed once you factor in debt from mortgages. Americans with a mortgage have an average overall debt of $209,000, compared with $11,600 for those without a mortgage. 20% of Americans with credit report have no debt. Only 20% are out of debt.
Wow.
That's kind of low, isn't it?
Yeah.
And the only thing that's keeping Japan going, Japan has a pretty good size debt to GDP ratio. But the thing that keeps Japan going is savings. That is something Americans do not share. The study also points out a disturbing trend. The share of Americans in collections has remained relatively constant, even as the country as a whole has whittled down the size of its credit card debt since the official end of the Great Recession, middle of 2009. Americans aren't using the good times to get out of debt, Steve. That's the problem. They're using the good times to coast in order that the bad times, the next recession, will be even worse. And that's the problem, see.
Yeah,
you've got to get another recession.
Yeah, or they get into more debt during the good times because they feel like it's all just going to keep coming in. I can buy the bigger house. I can get the nicer car and have fewer kids.
Yeah, it's too bad. Americans are not getting out of debt. They're not using this time to get out of debt. And, of course, our federal debt is just going insane.
Yeah. So if it's good enough for the government.
Not as if Obama has done anything to relieve that.
Yeah.
He has doubled the overall debt of this nation since he came into power. GWP, George W. Bush, did the same thing. He doubled the amount of debt that nation took on over his period of 8 years. Now, Barack Obama is doing the same thing over his reign of 8 years. America's debt to GDP ratio is outrageous. And we have relied upon the federal government to relieve us, to save us from our economic woes since the Great Depression. At least that's what we've tried to do. So
right.
We've increased the debt-to-GDP ratio again and again and again to fix every successive recession. And there comes a point at which you cannot increase the debt-to-GDP ratio anymore.
Right.
Comes a point at which the gross world product is not going to sustain that anymore. And I don't know when that happens. I'm not a prophet. I have no idea when that happens. All I know is the debtor is servant to the lender. The typical household now is worth a third less as well. Now, this one's, I think, even more of a shocker. The good times are over. We have said this again and again on the program. The good times are over. America, yes, has been the richest nation in the world. But we destroyed the character of the nation. And we got into as much debt as possible. We lived like existentialists for the moment, for ourselves. And we didn't worry about our children and our grandchildren. We didn't want to leave an inheritance to our children's children. The baby boom generation is in way more debt per capita than the silent generation when they retired. And the baby boomer generation is relying upon the Social Security Fund way more than any previous generation did. And yet the worker to retiree ratio will be one third of what it was for the silent generation and for the earlier generations as the baby boomers retire over the next 18 years. So we're headed for a disaster. This is going to be a train wreck unlike anything anybody's ever seen before because America was the richest nation in the world, and we have topped out. Over the last 10 years, the median income has been in free fall.
Yeah.
And the median worth, average worth, inflation-adjusted net worth for the typical household has been in free fall. It has fallen from $87,992 to, get this, over 10 years, the median net worth in America has fallen from $87,992 in 2003 to, get this, $56,335, or a 36% decline since 2003.
Wow.
That is knock your socks off. America is becoming impoverished.
Yeah.
This is the impoverishment of an empire, friends. This is the end. This is what it looks like economically. Yeah, Steve, I don't really hear this much from other news sources. People still believe we're in the good times.
Yeah.
It's like, crazy, baby, give me another beer, you know.
Yeah.
Party, dude, standing up in the convertible as we're moving 90 miles an hour towards the brick wall.
Yeah.
We are having a good time all the way till the big collapse. But it's already collapsing. The median inflation-adjusted net worth in America has dropped from $87,992 to $56,335 over the last 10 years. Now, it took a long time to get up to $87,992. Okay, think about this. We had to go through 50 years of technological advancement. We had to go through 50 years of baby boomers doing a lot of good work, a lot of scientific advancements, a lot of automation and computerization that enabled a lot of efficiency for our manufacturing systems. But you come to the point at which you can't do much more with it. You can't do much more with a nation that is in as much welfare as we are, a nation that has destroyed the character of the nation by way of the public schools, by way of the media, the culture, by way of churches that refuse to disciple the nation anymore by teaching anybody to observe anything that Jesus has commanded. You know, the consequence of the breakdown of the character of the nation is the breakdown of the economy of the nation. So, Steve, here we are in the good times. We're still in the good times. We're supposed to be in the good times, but we're not in the good times anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, one of my friends read a book or an article, I can't remember what it was, but he said that they did a study over the fall of all great empires, and it seemed that the thing that they were the proudest of, the most proud about, was the thing that God used to destroy them.
In this case, probably debt.
Yeah. So we are proud of our economy and our debt and our
proud of our feminism and our homosexuality.
And that's going to destroy us.
The egalitarianism within the marriage, the whole feminist thing where, you know, hey, you have sex before marriage and a job after, you know, hey, party, dude. The whole feminism thing and the aberrant homosexual thing and the 95% of Americans that confess to premarital sex on their marriage day. All of that is what they're proud of. They love it. They love it. They celebrate it all the time. These are the things that are destroying the social fabric and the economic fabric of the nation. And the socioeconomic system of this nation is in free fall right now.
And you look at abortion as well. I mean, we've got all these homes, all these cars, you know, that could have been purchased.
Sure.
And what we've done is we've killed our economy.
We did.
Killing our babies.
We killed 80 million babies.
Which would be
least 80 million. I think the numbers are as high as 200 million. I've gone between 80 million and 200 million. I'm not sure how many. It's pretty hard to figure it out because of the abortifacient effects. Yeah. But we have killed at least 80 million babies since 1960. And 80 million baby boomers are retiring over the next 18 years, in which the worker-to-retiree ratio will fall by one-third. It will be one-third of what it was in 1950 in 2030.
Yeah.
Now, does anybody have a brain out there? Does anybody do math? Do they teach math at Ohio State University anymore?
No. This is non sequiturs, yeah.
This is not a good recipe for success. This is. And here's the other factor. Understand the median household income has been in free fall for the last 6 years. The average median net worth for the typical household has fallen by 36%. Over the last 10 years, the median, it speaks to the average person. It doesn't take into account the super rich that would weigh out the number and pull the number that direction. The median is what the average ordinary Joe Schmo is worth, or the average household run by Joe and Jill Schmo is worth in America.
Yeah.
And it's fallen 36%. Now, at the same time, this is very interesting. The Russell Sage study also examined net worth at the 95 percentile. Now, what is that? That's way out there. That's where you've got the richer. For households at that level, 94% of the population had less wealth and 4% had more wealth. It found that for this well-to-do slice of the population, household net worth increased 14% over the same 10 years. Now, what are we talking about? We're talking about the most socialist, big government reign on the part of King Obama that this nation has ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
The more socialism you get, the more you squeeze out the middle class.
Yeah.
You aggrandize the lower class by way of welfare programs and by way of the minimum wage law. And you squeeze out the middle income guy who's trying to pull together a business and is getting regulated to death by middle income, by the minimum wage laws and all the regulations. So what happens in this nation, and what happens with all the regulatory state that Barack Obama has brought to this country over the last 8 years, is a destruction of the middle class. This is what communists have been doing from the very beginning. Minimum wage laws are counterproductive. The left is all about destroying the middle class by redistributing wealth, by the welfare programs. They destroy private incentives to excel. This keeps the poorest poor, and the rich are usually rewarded by monopolistic controls on the market produced by the heavy regulatory state. And that happens again and again and again. And that's really what they're all about. Now, you know, the pig in Animal Farm starts out saying everybody's going to be equal. It's all about equalitarianism. It's all about egalitarianism. And that's what Barack Obama and Napoleon the pig have been doing for the last 30, 40, 50 years of this nation's history. We're moving more and more towards socialism with big government controls on private industry. And they've been doing it again and again under Republicans and Democrats. I'm not just blaming it on President Obama. I think it's happened over a long period of time where the take of government over the GNP has increased from 10% to roughly 60%. So what is the consequence of socialism? Always, always, always the destruction of the middle class. This has been the goal of communists, and it is the goal of socialists, and it is the goal of Barack Obama. He won't tell you it's his goal, but it is his goal.
Yeah, he says it's the other way.
The goal is to destroy the middle class.
Yeah, he says he wants to save the middle class.
He doesn't do that. No. By socialism and by big government policies in the regulatory state, it always rewards the large monopolistic fascist corporations, and the middle-income guy is squeezed out of the picture. Meantime, the minimum wage laws destroy the average ordinary little service industry operation in your little towns across America. Okay, so that's what's happened, friends. That's what's happened. And, of course, if the character of the nation is being eroded by welfare and the use of welfare, food stamps, et cetera, has gone exponential over the last 10 years or so, of course, you've got the medium income moving down into the poor class. The poor class, their character is being destroyed piece by piece by piece, and so you get a large poor class and a large wealthy class that is usually aggrandized by payoffs and bribes, and call them campaign contributions, call them whatever you want. You've got to pull together $600 million to get Barack Obama or the next Barack Obama elected as president of the United States anyway. And that money has to come from somewhere. It's probably coming from banks and those that are aggrandized by the policies of national governments that are in control of so many things and are fascist to the core. Okay, friends, well, that's the end result. That's the end game. How do we fix these things? My encouragement is you get a copy of my book, The Second Mayflower. Do you want to run at this one more time? Do you want to create a free country where there's some semblance of righteousness, justice, some semblance of the Eighth Commandment, thou shalt not steal, incorporated on the institutional basis at the highest echelons of a country? Then get a copy of my book, The Second Mayflower. Figure out how to rebuild a good country, a solid country, a God-blessed country one more time. If we have that opportunity in the next generation or two, I think we may have it. I think we may very well have it. Nations come down, empires come down, and it always gives us a chance to rebuild new countries, oftentimes decentralized little nations. And America may split into decentralized countries as well sometime in the future. I deal with that in my book, The Second Mayflower, available at our website, kevinswanson.com. Get a copy of The Second Mayflower today at kevinswanson.com. This is Kevin Swanson. We'll be back in just a moment with more on how to restore the economy. And now we're going to go down to restoring the character of our young men. That's critical. Be back in a moment. This is Kevin Swanson. Hey dads, is it time to get away with your sons to build those relationships? Remember, fruitful relationships is what it takes to have a fruitful life. How you disciple your son has everything to do with the relationship you have with your son. So don't miss a once-in-a-lifetime experience at our father-son retreat at the Crooked Creek Ranch in the Colorado Rockies this August. This year, we will be featuring speakers like Scott Brown, Dan Einerson, Mike Chappa, Steve Vaughn, and yours truly from the Generations Radio program. You'll enjoy outdoor activities, training sessions, including wilderness first aid, mountain survival, blood tracking, as well as sports activities, swimming, high ropes course, rock climbing walls, kayaking, and hiking in the beautiful Colorado Rockies. And we're cutting the price for the 2014 Father-Son Retreat. It all happens August 28th to the 31st at the most fabulous retreat center in the Colorado Rockies. Register today for our Father-Son Retreat at check.org, that's C-H-E-C.org, that's check.org under Check Events on the web, or call toll-free 877-842-2432. That's 877-842-2432. The Generations Radio broadcast talking about salvaging a socioeconomic system. But friends, comes a point at which you can't salvage the Titanic, but you can do something with an emergency life raft here and there. So we got to transfer from time to time from fixing the country to working with what we have, being faithful in small things, the families, the churches, the communities in which we live. So this ties in. I think this email ties into the previous content, Steve. Yeah, we're looking at the destruction of the richest nation in the world right now. Interesting. But how does this apply to you and me and our families? Here's a letter written from somebody who listens to the program on a regular basis. We really enjoy your podcast, appreciate your ministry. Would you please address the subject of video games for young Christian boys? We're a homeschooling family. Almost all of our Christian friends allow their boys to play video games. We have found even relatively good games seemed like a waste of time. We have tried to give our boy opportunities to do more productive things, but he also sees his friends playing video games and wants to be like them. We don't want to set up a rebellious spirit in him. Would you consider addressing this issue in one of your programs? Well, number one, yeah, it's hard to work through an issue like this. It's not easy. One of the problems is we're entertaining ourselves to death as a nation. And when you're in a culture where that's what everybody else is doing, it's very difficult to come out from among them and be set. Very difficult. Extremely difficult. Yes, you want to love your son and point out how much you love your son. You can't replace something with nothing. The idea of saying no, 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 but the family never does anything. And dad never spends time with son. And we never really get involved in doing things on a day-to-day basis that could be helpful and nutritious and replace his empty time with something productive. Yeah, that could really frustrate your son and provoke him to wrath. You don't want to do that. Nevertheless, I have to say, I don't think computer games are that helpful. I think it's been hurtful. Even where we have allowed our children some access to computer games, looking back, we think to ourselves we should have been even more conservative on that point. We're regretful that we allowed some of our children access to computer games. And so we're looking back and saying, I would have done it differently if I had done it again. Well, I've got some statistics here, Steve, but do you have anything to say about video games on the front side of this?
Well, one of the things that I've seen and read is that with video games and doing anything, so when our bodies, God has designed us to accomplish things. He set us out to subdue and to accomplish and to discover his world. And when we do accomplish something, there is a chemical release within our bodies that gives us a pleasurable experience. The problem is our brains don't know the difference between video games and building something physical. And so when you get through level 3 or level 20 of whatever, you get that same feeling and you feel accomplishment and you want to do it again and again. And you get that same feeling when you work with your hands. And so I think that's one of the problems. That's how you get addicted to video games.
And it turns out not to be productive.
Right. Nothing changes.
So you don't build anything that way. Whereas when you're working with your hands, you're producing something helpful. And it feeds into the things you're supposed to be doing day by day. 6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work. But the seventh is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. In it thou shalt not do any work. God wrote that.
Right.
He knows what he's dealing with there. Work is important, and in the same commandment, he says you take the Sabbath off, you and your son, your daughter. The assumption is there's a family economy going on, and your son, your daughters, are working alongside you over those 6 days, therefore take the seventh off. That principle of work 6 days, take the seventh off, I believe still abides. Now, there's some debate on whether that seventh day is going to be Sunday or Saturday. I understand there's debates on which day you take off and do not work as the Sabbath. Nevertheless, the six-day requirement for work still holds. There needs to be work going on in our homes. And I think this is probably the major issue, is because there are no viable family economies, or very few viable family economies out there, we're dealing with all these other issues. I think these other issues would go away if people built family economies. Also, one more reason, friends, to attend our family economics conferences coming up in Virginia and Kansas over the next, 4 months, I think October, November. Check it out at familyeconomics.com. Again, so many things I think would be solved if people would understand the basic biblical concept of the family economy. We bring out the biblical principles relating to economy in our family economics conferences, of which family economy is incredibly basic, but it's been virtually lost in our highly segregated, individualized corporate world of the modern age. Check out our family economics conferences at familyeconomics.com. You can't replace something with nothing. I wish we had these conferences back in 1997, Steve, when we started out with our little 4-year-old and 6-year-old and 10-year-old. I wish we had some access to these things back then. But they are accessible today. 3 conferences around the United States this year put on by familyeconomics.com. I should be there at both conferences. I invite you down to the conference. Now, statistics-wise, wow, the use of computer games way, way, way up. Currently, there are 500 million people worldwide playing computer games at least an hour a day. 500 million people, 3 million people in America alone, playing video games at least an hour a day. 99% of boys under 18 and 94% of girls under 18 report playing video games regularly. Now that's why it's very hard to live in community, in a church community, in a youth group community, in a Sunday school community, or whatever community, or day school, whatever it is. It's very hard to live in a community with boys and girls that are sucked into this thing, and your children not want to share in it.
Yeah.
It's almost impossible. So number one, it's almost impossible, practically impossible to live in a community where the 99% of boys and girls are playing the games and your kids are not. Extremely difficult. Extremely difficult. You might have to find a different community. I hate to say that. There are other factors that play into this, so don't just use this as the single factor that plays in. But Time Magazine has an article that came out just about a month ago. Here's how much time people spend playing video games. Average hours are on the rise in the United States. Now, the concern about addiction is an important concern. We're not talking about increase in the number of people playing computer games. We're talking about the average hours that the average person playing computer games plays those games. That is on the rise. So what does that mean? That means that here's the zeitgeist. You start playing the games, the average person plays more and more and more and more. That's what happens. Because the games are, by definition, addictive. The average hours are on the rise in the United States. The average hours, according to Time Magazine, this is May 27, 2014, average hours 2011 was 5.1. In a year, increased by half an hour, 5.6. And then another half an hour by 2013 to 6.3. So at that rate, Steve, you're looking at people, the average person being virtually addicted to this thing within about 5 years.
Yeah.
At that rate, we're looking at virtual addiction for the average person playing computer games by the year 2019. In the worldwide market, I'm looking at just general numbers. This is probably one of the most significant shifts in the zeitgeist in the last 20 years. So that's why it's important. Things have changed dramatically because of computer games. This is the one factor in the world of entertainment that has changed dramatically. Music hasn't changed. Movies haven't changed. DVD sales hasn't changed. And I'll give you some of these numbers in just a second. Book sales is down. Way, way down.
Yeah.
So, but computer game is just way, way, way up. 1982, $2 billion industry. It's almost nothing. 1993, $31 billion industry. It increased by a factor of 15 times in just 10 years. That's when my little brother Tim was playing.
Yeah.
Mario Brothers. I remember that. It was a little Nintendo. That the increase in the 1980s was significant, from $2 billion to $31 billion. In 2012, it was up to $68 billion. 2014, it will be $93 billion. It's, again, on the increase. The exponent is moving. By 2017, $128 billion. Meanwhile, the worldwide film industry has been static for about 10 years. Hasn't increased at all. In fact, the computer game industry has now increased to the size where it's bigger than all of these other industries. Music industry, the movie industry, the book industry, the DVD industry. It's larger than all these industries. The computer game industry is now the largest entertainment industry in the world. You do remember it took about 50 to 60 years to build a movie industry and a music industry to where it is today.
Yeah.
But these things have flatlined. In fact, the music industry is down 6% since 2003. Bookstore sales have dropped about 30% since 2007. Total sales for books have dropped about 20% since 2007. So people aren't reading anymore. People are playing games. They're playing games. They're playing games. Well, ladies and gentlemen, the problem right now is out of control. And I've got some other stuff here on reading. A very important study came out from the Common Sense Media Group in which it turns out children who read for fun every day, 9-year-olds about the same as it was in 1984, 13-year-olds, 33% versus 27%, but 17-year-olds, it's 31% versus 19%, meaning there's a huge drop-off in the number of 17, 18, and 19-year-olds who read. Huge drop-off. It's way, way, way lower than 9-year-olds and 13-year-olds, meaning that you get into your junior high and high school years, you're getting dumber and dumber and dumber. Your smartest year is when you're 9 years old. after that, you're getting stupider and stupider and stupider. You're reading less books, and you're reading way, way less books than 17-year-olds were reading back in 1984. The moral of the story is, don't do teen culture. Do not let your kids hang out with other teens that participate in a dumbed-down culture in which they're not reading, in which they're playing games, in which they are abandoning reality on about 1,000 different levels. You've got to be very careful with pop culture, teen culture, and what's happening right now, friends. This problem is metastasizing. It's not just a fact that these kids are absorbed in music and movies. It's way more significant than that. These young people are pulled into all of these various games in which the negative effects are everywhere. Here's a study that just came out a year or two ago by the Pediatric Clinics of North America, Children, Adolescents, and the Media, in which they looked at video games. Negative effects were all over the place. Aggressive cognition, effect and behavior, empathy, desensitization, attention deficit, cognitive control, going off the deep end, video game addiction increasing exponentially, video games and school performance down, down, down as the gamers spend more time in their games. Positive effects, they have a few positive effects. Educational games are good. Games in which you share together, where there's social contact is a good thing. But man, how many games involve educational benefit and where there's decent social contact happening? Not very many. Moral of the story, when it comes to games, do a family economy instead. Do a family, whatever it takes, do a family economy instead. Read the Word of God. And if you do games, do them together. If I had this to do over again, Steve, I'd say no games at all for any individual playing games by themselves. Play a game together, where there's at least two or three, four, five people, the family's together doing a board game. Maybe you're doing some electronic game, but you're doing it together in the same room. I'm okay with that. I'm okay with that. But anything beyond that, I would reject. I would reject. Do things together. That's the moral of this story. And friends, we're out of time. We'll talk about these issues more and more as time progresses, because we are talking about salvaging something of a civilization, something of a social system, something of parent-child relationships, something of an economy, something of a family economy. I don't think macroeconomy is going to do well, but hey, we might be able to salvage some micros in the process. Check out FamilyEconomics.com for more information on our Family Economics Conferences. Find a way to revitalize your family from the bottom up at our Family Economics Conferences. At FamilyEconomics.com, this is Kevin Swanson inviting you back again next time as we continue to lay down a vision for the next generation.